Learn Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less with author Greg McEwen.
Let's take a question.
The first thing that pops into my head as the most non-essentialist thing in my life right now is probably my email inbox.
Yeah.
Suggests that we do on that front.
Burn it. I'm just kidding. Every so often people tell me, they'll be like, I only check my email once on Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock. And I'm always like, I think you might be lying. Yeah, email is a really big challenge with this. Here's my first suggestion. Make sure, never, if you can, to let your inbox be your to-do list. That's the default for most people now. Because no matter what you do first, the next thing you're going to do is check your email. The idea that we're addicted, I used to think was just a metaphor. I think it's literal. We're really addicted. Because something terrible could happen every time we check it. Oh, it could be terrible. I must check. Could be amazing. Got to check. Most of the time, it's neither. And it keeps us there. So there's lots of things that have been written, lots of things in terms of managing this. But I think the best idea is you really do wait to certain times of the day. You say, and just expand it. If you check every minute, try checking every 3 minutes. If you check every 3 minutes, try checking every half an hour. And get to the point where you go, look, I will go through all my emails. I will respond to you. It's not like a Luddite. You just pretend that email is going to be gone. It doesn't matter. But just put it together so it doesn't guide your life, doesn't lead your life. You know, the email is a good servant, but a really poor master. That's what I think. Good. Next.
What are some strategies you would recommend to exploring what is essential to us?
If I had to simplify it to a single thing, I'd recommend that you hold a personal quarterly offsite. A personal quarterly, every 90 days, offsite. So, you know, like in a company, every so often, maybe every quarter, takes the executive team and they go off and they plan. They say, what's going on in our company? And what are the really big trends? And where are we going? And what adjustments do we need to make? I think that works for businesses and it works for our own lives. So once every 90 days, you take a day. Maybe you start off, it's only like 2 or 3 hours, but you find you want more than that over time. You schedule it. You put it on your calendar. You protect it. You make it happen. And then you just get to review. You get to look over the whole of your, what have I been doing over the last 90 days? What has mattered? What hasn't mattered? And you come out of that process with like 2 or 3 goals that you think that's what really feels essential to me for the next 90 days. An example of this, I was working with the CEO of, what's it called? Not Uber, but when you rent an apartment, you know, people's houses, Airbnb, thank you. And I was working with them and the whole company. And he said the most productive we've ever been was the first 90 days of our company. Actually, it wasn't the first 90 days. It was a particular 90 days because they were all over the place at the beginning. Did you know this? Airbnb was so ridiculously not what they are today. They used to sell cereal. Not just cereal, but here was their big idea when they were first pitching to investors. We're going to have Democratic cereal and Republican cereal. That is absolutely true. And so, you know, like early investors are like, nope, we're not putting money into that. And now they kind of wish they had because they managed to pivot into something a little bigger. And they said, finally, their goal became for 90 days, they had a singular goal. The priority was we are going to be what they called ramen profitable within 90 days. Like if we only eat ramen noodles morning, evening, and night for 90 days, we will be able to show that we have made money renting out this airbed in our apartment. We're going to show you can make money doing this thing. And for 90 days, they lived and breathed that goal. And by the end, they were able to show it to an investor and they were able to get their investment, at least the first round of it. That's what a personal quarterly offsite's about. So this is the thing that must be done. It doesn't mean you only do one thing. I think it's sort of 2 or 3 things, but you know what the single priority is by the end of your offsite. That's one thing I'd suggest to you. Good. More.
I suggest to you also for me is the thing you mentioned earlier about doing like a 5-year vision too. Really managing your life, what you want your life to look like for 5 years, and then use that as a template of figuring out, okay, 90 days later, am I, or is that still what my life? What will that look like? Can I do it sooner than 5 years?
And I'm going to just want to blow that up a little bit by saying, for the longest time, I was constricted by the idea that long-term visioning would be the end of my life. By the end of my life, what do I want my life to have been about? You see, and that seemed like very, very long-term thinking compared to the email, it's an email kind of existence. And then finally, I realized it was far too short a period that I need to start with a 100-year vision. I must get beyond myself beyond my own birth-to-death narrative and start to see my own contribution within the range of intergenerational. So I need to go back 100 years before and think about what my grandparents and great-grandparents, what they were doing, who they were, what they gave me, what they left me, what mattered 100 years down the road, to learn from all of that. And most of the time, people know almost nothing 100 years back, which is kind of amazing because they like defined almost everything about us. The language we speak, the place we live, the ideas that we've been exposed to are massively influenced by these people we know nothing about. So 100 years before and 100 years after, and let all of that kind of huge long-term thinking inform this moment. That's the goal, I think. So it's like, I might think about it like sometimes it's called the long, long now. Long in the back, long in the front, so that you then figure out what's important now. And let that kind of perspective affect you. Okay, another one. Go.
You talk about what's important, like if you split your life into different aspects, professional and personal and community. What if those things that are important are in conflict?
Yeah, they will be, won't they? Well, what do you do when you have different constituency groups wanting different things from you? Whenever people ask this, as they often do, I want to respond with something like, well, what do you do now? Because essentialism didn't make that problem, right? Like I only jokingly, but I'm like, well, I didn't start that. Essentialism just draws attention to the problem we already have, which is many, many people want many different things from us. And the non-essentialist just starts trying to do all of it for everyone. And the essentialist starts to say, well, okay, so they're in conflict. Let's talk about it. Let's weigh it. Let's explore it. Let's figure out of all these different groups, let's put all the different groups I serve up and let me prioritize the whole list. So I know clearly who is, you know, like in boxing, you have the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. I want to know who the undisputed priority relationship in my life is. And I do know, and the answer is my wife, right? And it is the undisputed priority in my life. And I want that to be so clear to her, to me, to everybody. I want that to be clear. Because if it's not really clear, you're going to end up making really bad choices. That's what's happened. I have done that. I'll tell you experience. This was very personal experience that drove me towards essentialism as the subject matter of the book. And it was when a boss, my manager at the time, sends me this email, says, Friday would be a very bad time for your wife to have a baby. And, you know, maybe they were joking, sort of, right? But don't joke like that. That's what I think now. So Thursday nights, very late in the middle of the night, that's when a daughter's born. I'm in the hospital Friday morning with everyone. Everyone's okay because I'm exhausted and so on. But to my shame, I went to the meeting. And afterwards, I remember my manager saying, well, they'll respect you for the choice you made. I mean, the client will. And maybe they did, but I don't know that they did. But regardless, I'd made a fool's bargain. I'd believed, look, if I can just do both, it'll work out. But it doesn't, you see, when you make these trade, when you don't make the trade-offs, when you sort of go, well, this is clearly more important, but that's also really important. When you start to pretend that almost everything's even close to being as important, we're going to make judgment errors. So I want to know with clarity who's the most important. I want to hold these up and get clear about it. And that's what you do in the personal course of the offsite. That's what you do when you do the deep thinking. That's what you do when you make the mistakes, which we're all going to do about this subject. You face it, you own it, you go, okay, well, that was a mess. That violated something. Let's get clearer again. I think that's what you do. You've got to at least get clear about it. That doesn't mean you have to suddenly start saying no and ruining relationships instantly. No, that doesn't, I didn't write that. I believe in that. But now you know where to negotiate. Now you know if it comes down to it, which one you're going to choose. And over time, you're going to actually pursue the strategy you intend to pursue. That's my answer to that. Okay, go.
As you're developing a sort of like language or like nomenclature around this idea, because it is so entrenched in our culture, and I do think we've been told a bill of goods and we don't recognize it. I work with a lot of CEOs. I'm a personal trainer.
Right. I bet you are.
Yeah. And when I ask them to describe how they're feeling or how their day was, they usually can't come up with a feeling. Exhausted, but they often use metaphors like they're getting beaten up. There's a lot of like fighting and punching. And
sounds so awfully familiar, doesn't it?
Metaphors, yeah. And I feel like we don't have, but I also think there's like a little PTSD or like Stockholm syndrome around it too. I don't think we have a lot of examples in our culture of the alternative. So like when I say that I run long races or I run long distances, people are like, she's a freak. But what I'm really doing is it's an expression of my interpretation of essentialism. Like,
correct.
It's what you're talking about. Every 90 days, I go someplace else to run through the woods for a very long time with no cell phone and no one can interrupt me.
Exactly.
Very, like, intense moment of solitude, reconnection, and reflection. And then every day, I choose to run for 30 minutes or 45 minutes or whatever. Again, it's a micro version of that. Mm-hmm. So when people see what I'm doing, I'm a freak, and they disappear right away.
Right, because what you're saying is, in a world that is culturally here, you have a practice. We don't know about the whole of your life. You haven't talked about that, but there's a certain part of your life that's over here. And it looks so different to over here. And it's totally true. Essentialism is more countercultural than I realized it was when I wrote it. And of course, I knew that it was countercultural. That's the only justification for doing it. But it's way more countercultural than I understood. It's just everybody's over here. So to be over here is such an oddity. But it's changing. Go.
And then people also, once they kind of figure out what my schedule is like or the choices I made, then it's like, oh, nice for you.
That's right. As if we don't have a choice.
Yeah.
We have to be here. We have to be. Because that's what everyone else is doing and that's what we've seen. And there's something about non-essentialism that breeds non-essentialism too.
Absolutely.
So that the more you're trapped by it, the more you're engaged in it, the less you can think about doing something else. So busyness begets busyness. And such a thing happens, and we almost, I think, into a busyness bubble. Just like the real estate bubble before it, you know, and all these previous bubbles, where there's this irrational exuberance where people are outdoing themselves and telling everyone how busy they are. I'm so busy. Oh, I'm so busy. I'm busier than you. Let me tell you how about my story. I'm busy. I slept on average 4 hours a night for the last 2 weeks. See, that's how important I am. I mean, busy I am. You know, there's a celebration of this. But it isn't based in reality or truth. There's something else. So inevitably, essentialism will win. Essentialism will win just every bit as much as Desmond Tutu was right that inevitably apartheid would fall. Desmond Tutu said, I used to meet all the time with P.W. Botha, who was the president of South Africa at the time. And I used to say to him all the time, come join the winning side. He said, because even though at the time, ostensibly, we were clearly on the losing side, right? This was the gas laws. The whole system was against us. We were clearly losing. He said, but I believe that we lived in a world of natural law, of God's law. He said, it was no way that those natural principles, that goodwill would not prevail. I love that idea, and I believe it applies to everything we're talking about today, that ultimately, if you move to essentialism, you're moving to the winning side. Ultimately, it will win because non-essentialism is based on a false premise. And false premises, however long they go for a while, it's all a bubble and ultimately burst. And then everyone will look at it and go, what? You lived how? You did what? This is crazy. How did people do that? Like the people that had 5 different mortgages in the middle of the... We all think they were crazy people now, but they weren't. They were just going with the flow. No, going with this flow is a dangerous path. In fact, just in the last day and a half, I was doing a lot of media appointments, and I used to do media in a particular way. I used to do it like, okay, I've got my script, and I got to keep to my script and do it. And then like I would repeat it because we do these media days, and I'd repeat it like 9 times, and I felt like I was going crazy by the end of the day. I'm like, I cannot tell that story again. And so now I don't even bother with that, and I don't know if it'll work, but I just talk to people. And whatever they ask, I just tell them what I really feel and think at this moment. And it's quite cathartic. That's what I'm learning. It's like a kind of media therapy. And I found myself this last day, as I've been doing this, going, I haven't gone far enough yet. I mean, like, I don't profess to be an essential to me. I don't profess to have it all figured out at all. I live in the real world. I live in the grappling. But I find myself having made these decisions. I've done some things towards this. And I just want to go further. I just feel the winds of change that I want to get to a point where I just bolder over here. Because at the end of our lives, we may regret lots of things, but I just don't buy for a second that at the end of my life, I'm going to regret that I was too essentialist. I was just too focused on the really important things. I just wish I had just given into more expectation for more people to do more different things that they happen to want me to do. I mean, I just don't buy that. I don't think any of us will. We will get other things, but not that. So there's other questions, but I am conscious of some people in the room are going to be like, I really kind of want to leave now, but I don't want to be rude. So should we just do one more question? Let's do one more. We'll do one more. Okay, here.
The person pursue a less can we actually be brave to support pursue mastery? Like we all tend to be kind of jack of all people, but somehow we are missing that one thing which we really are wanted. Especially considering the 20th century education system. You all have certain kind of field, or you want okay, you all have to study all these things and after that thing you get to and you don't actually understand, everybody doesn't understand themselves at a level that, okay, what do you exactly want to do in life? Yeah.
And then you go to college.
Master. I think that's the biggest flaw in the 21st century, in the 20th century,
educational system. It was inherently non-essentialist.
Yeah, exactly.
It's totally true.
And that's why every single individual is somewhere in deep inside is missing what exactly they want to do in their life.
Yeah, so then they get to 40. And they have a crisis.
They're like, what the hell am I doing?
Yeah, why couldn't you ask that question at 5 years old?
Exactly.
And carried on asking it?
Exactly. And then really telling them, what's that one thing which they really want to ask you?
Yeah.
And then essentialism can actually be like, you want relevant to each 30 different things. Find that one mastery, one thing which you can actually master. That's why most of the sportsperson, most of the athletes,
yeah, sure.
Singers or musicians, which you know today, who are really famous, I think they actually tapped into the right.
Yeah.
That focus, the first point, which was in your circle,
yeah.
Which was, I don't know what is that, explore.
Yeah.
Explore that thing at a very young age.
That's right. Yeah,
they did it at a very young age. They kind of, that's in their 30s.
Yeah.
They are not confused about it. They already have seen the success.
Yeah, to master anything, you must be an essentialist. And if you find it, basically anybody who is superb at anything, you will find that they were an essentialist. Like the evidence is everywhere at the people at the top performance. You'll find that they were more focused on what they did, and you will find that they slept more. That's really true. Both of those things are true. Because the sleep enabled them to spend higher quality hours focused on their thing. Because when they were awake, they were able to really engage in whatever their thing, whether it's violin or whether it's sport or whatever it is. But literally, their average is about 8.5 hours sleep of the highest performers. They sleep more at night and they also take more naps. That's such an oddity, isn't it? Think of how that compares to the non-essentialist mantra. Do it all, sleep less, stuff it all in. What a bunch of junk. What rubbish. Lesson. Slightly sad note to leave it on anyway, isn't it? But thank you very much for being here. Thank you.